Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, an unusual thematic unity to the show. In moments, we'll hear the economic historian Adam Tooze talking about globalization, American imperial power, and Donald Trump. And then at the bottom of the hour, the political scientist Leo Panitch, a frequent guest on this show, will talk about many of the same topics. Before getting to the substance, I want to apologize for some of the audio quality on this show. Summer means vacations and less than ideal setups for both host and guests. I've been writing and talking about globalization for something like 25 years. I've been skeptical of many of the master narratives around it, both the neoliberal triumphalist version and the leftist critique that held it to be the principal source of evil in the modern world. All along, I thought that globalization narratives overlooked centuries of historical continuity and not just capitalism, but a deep human need to move about. But now the sort of globalization the 90s made famous looks to be under severe attack by nationalists across the globe. What does it all mean? First to address these issues is Adam Tooze. Tooze is an economic historian at Columbia. His most recent book is Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World, which is about to be published in the U.S. We'll have him back on the show to discuss that in a month or so. Adam Tooze. The discourse around globalization is confusing sometimes. When has capitalism ever not been a global system? It's been globalizing for centuries. Maybe the 1930s were an exception, at least in the direction, and that was hardly a good time. So what about this word? I mean, how helpful is it to use this term globalization to describe the economic scene today?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the capitalism has always been globally constituted. I mean, it was merges simultaneously with the European state system in the late medieval, early modern period, arguably, as it were, simultaneously imbricated and tied up with Western expansion. So I would absolutely grant that. And I think, broadly speaking, globalization has been ongoing in a kind of, not continuous, but a ebb and flow. It's a processual thing that has gathered intensity over time. I think, however, you can kind of draw lines in here. A school of thought, which I'm very attached to, argues that the mid-19th century is an absolutely crucial turning point in that the density of interconnection from that moment onwards really kind of closes the frontier, if you like, constitutes a truly integrated or at least articulated system from which virtually no part of the globe is exempt anymore, so that what had previously been regional power centers and regional struggles are now actually integrated into something like a global whole. And it's the British Empire and the technological infrastructure, the commercial infrastructure it puts in place, which provides the frame for that. A lot of us talk about this using a phrase from Michael Geyer and Charlie Bright called the global condition. In other words, there's a state, we're no longer in a system which has always had global ramifications, and we're no longer just simply undergoing a trend towards greater globalization, but we're actually qualitatively shifted. There are similar logics operating in the last half century or so, where one has to say that quantity tips into qualitative change, where the scale of interaction, the degree of integration is just simply unlike anything we've ever seen before. If you think about, say, the smartphone complex production in East Asia, where an entire mega region is subsumed within, you know, the logic of the design process and production process, which is famously based elsewhere, notably in California, and then spanned out to global markets. Or if you think about the way in which auto production, motor vehicle production is now truly global or mega regional and then integrated by means of trade and capital and technology flows at the global level. This is new. And likewise with finance, there had, of course, always been, well, not always, certainly by the late 19th century, London had constituted itself as an unprecedented type of financial hub, one of the factors which I think makes the late 19th century a qualitatively different moment. But what we saw from the 70s onwards, with the extent of integration, especially in the North Atlantic economy between European and American finance, is qualitatively new as a result of just massive integration of balance sheets on both sides of the Atlantic, which is one of the things which exploded in 08 with such disruptive force.
But I've seen on Twitter citing studies showing that the U.S. economy still remains overwhelmingly domestic. I saw one instance of something like 84% of what we consume is of domestic origin, and that India, a country with some experience with the British Empire, is far more globally integrated than the United States is. What about that? Are people really reading the degree of the U.S.'s economic troubles coming from globalization? Are they reading that correctly?
Oh, well, that's a kind of different level of argument, right? So I would agree with you. Those numbers are surprising because one talks a lot about globalization and many ills of American society and the American economy are blamed on globalization. And there's a deeply held belief that, say, the troubles of the American working class are largely the result of international trade and globalization, which just doesn't stand up in quantitative terms. I would grant you that immediately. One of the, the largest estimates of the China shock in U.S. manufacturing can only account for a fraction of the increase in inequality, which has blighted American society in the last couple of decades. So that's absolutely granted. There's another major statistical effect you have to reckon with, which is that as sectors become more productive, their significance in terms of measured GDP declines, right? So looking at American GDP, you'd say that agriculture was a completely trivial part of the U.S. economy and far less important than it was in the 19th century, which is, ridiculous at one level because it's clear that American farms are more productive than ever. Far more food is produced in the United States and it's exported all over the world. It's just that we've gotten so efficient at doing so, and prices are in relative terms so low that they're hugely outweighed by sectors like higher education, which I work in, which has, regressive productivity tendencies. Its price is going up all the time in the private sector anyway, likewise in healthcare. And so those GDP numbers give you a read on particular dynamics, but they're not a very good indicator of systemic interconnection at the level of how production is actually operating and how things hang together. But I agree, if the thrust of your question is towards explaining massive rise in inequality and the struggles of the American working class over the last 30 to 40 years, one could easily exaggerate the significance of globalization in that story. And any big economic unit, this is true of Japan too, it's true of China, it's true of the EU, if you net out all of the trade within the EU, all of these economic units are, relatively speaking, less globalized than one might imagine, given the prevalent image we have of a massively interconnected world. Because in all of their GDPs, domestically traded services, predominantly.
What do you cite as the source of the polarization and the increasing distress of the American working class, which is also affecting the British and continental European working class as well, leading to things like Brexit and the wave of anti-immigrant sentiment across Western Europe? What is the source if globalization is exaggerated as the culprit?
The class logic of American society by itself, entire unto itself and operating within the compass of the United States, would be perfectly adequate to describe what's happening. It will account for the vast majority of the polarization. The force of globalization in a double sense, in the sense that there's a reserve army of labor across much of the world which can be deployed on the one hand, and at the other end, that American capital can earn such spectacular profits in its operations abroad as it does, and those feed back into the high income, the wealth and income of the top couple of percent of the American population. That's the icing on the cake, but the domestic struggles are perfectly sufficient to explain the kind of logics of polarization we see in the U.S. The difference between Europe and the U.S. is largely, certainly if you take a country like Germany, is on the post-tax side. So Germany is a substantially more equal society once you allow for taxes and welfare. So in the American case, you need to add in the fact that the tax and welfare changes since the 1970s have had the effect of not softening or in some cases even exacerbating the tendency towards inequality, whereas the European welfare states are on the whole still doing a reasonably energetic job of compensating for pre-tax inequality by means of redistribution and producing substantially less unequal outcomes in the post-tax Gini's post-tax inequality measures. So I would put those three things together: the domestic struggle in the United States, which of course includes the deployment of technology at work, the development of labor-saving technologies of various types, but also concrete battles to exclude labor, organized labor from the American workplace, and to shift the battle the effects of tax and welfare changes, and then thirdly, globalization as a third element. This is a multifactorial story, but the majority of the work in explaining this is really domestic or at most regional factors.
I'm speaking with the economic historian Adam Tooze. And turning to Trump, how do you read his protectionist policies and threats? Are there sectors of U.S. capital or sectors of U.S. elites that are actually pushing for this kind of policy? Do you see there's a strategy behind what he's doing to open up foreign markets, or is he just using his own personal xenophobia to win votes from disaffected portions of the U.S. population? What's behind it?
It's a kaleidoscope, I think. I mean, it's really difficult to figure it out. Obviously, like you, I'm sure, just sort of I'm immersed in the flow of commentary and about this on a daily basis. It's a puzzling phenomenon as I can remember trying to figure out. I mean, it's got multiple layers. I came up with five when I last made a kind of itemization. The first is the kind of MAGA, the blunt political logic of being seen to be doing something for blue-collar America because you need to make America great again, and so you need to do things at the kind of clunky, heavy industrial level because everyone understands that's what blue-collar America is about. And, of course, it's a completely crude travesty of what the realities of American life are, but I think that helps us get to the kind of steel, aluminium, and then the sort of really bizarre mobilization of autos as a sector where you're going to fight a fight, which is, you know, from the point of view of the logic of American capital, completely opaque. Then I think there's the reverb of the NAFTA battles of the 1990s. And to me, like, Trump's decision-making process has a real kind of recursive, kind of slightly locked-in kind of quality. And there's the NAFTA struggles of the 1990s are part of that vocabulary, and you can mobilize them alongside straight being xenophobia, building a wall, MS-13, animals, you know, that whole kind of rhetoric. Then I think we begin to get to more serious components. I mean, one of which I think is the China shock. I mean, it's belated. I think almost everyone agrees now that the real damage was done to the U.S. in the period of massive Chinese undervaluation in the early 2000s. That's when almost all the job losses are done. But this is where folks like Lighthizer and Navarro really began to dig in the late 90s, critiquing the Clinton administration's promotion of Chinese WTO membership and really developing a fairly coherent, in their own terms, critique of what a qualitative difference it made that you had bolted a state monopoly or a state capitalist system into, you know, the so-called liberal world trading system. And I think there we begin to see something that resembles much more a kind of coherent strategic logic. But how it at this point actually relates to the interests of American capital, I think, is extremely unclear, because like Apple, for instance, has made a one-country play on China as its manufacturing hub. Like, it doesn't have any alternative. It's not like Samsung, whose, I think, biggest factory is in Vietnam. Apple's 100% committed to China as its manufacturing base. GM sells more cars in China now than it does in the U.S. So from their point of view, it would be disastrous, I think, if this escalates towards some more general standoff. And you can see the German and the Japanese and the South Korean car manufacturers rubbing their hands as America's sales in China decline. You can kind of see there the elements of the strategic logic, but it's not really, we may have passed the tipping point. And I think where you really begin to see something which actually has a more hard edge is in tech. And that's, I think, the kind of new dimension that's come to the fore. But my sense is that that's really more the security establishment. That's people from the security side of the American power structure who really are beginning to worry about America's preeminence in the core technologies, control over, you know, chip-making technology, or at least parity, or, you know, privileged access to the big Taiwanese foundries. These kind of issues which really resemble struggles over the transfer of technology during the Cold War. Again, it's very unclear, I think, where the balance of capital's interest lies in this. And then the final element is the retaliation. So then, you know, how, of course, when you act on a world that's not inert, flak starts coming back at you, it starts flying, and people have to react in various ways. And that then adds a further element. So it's a incredible kind of kaleidoscope, which is then shifted by the, you know, the erratic nature of decision-making within the Trump administration. So it's very difficult. You know, if you looked at, say, something like climate change, you'd be able to say, okay, it's clear what's at stake here. It's coal interests. They want to just hold up the Paris agenda as long as they can. It's a fairly straightforward thing. But with the tariff position, it's, I see the security element clearly, and then I see a bunch of kind of belated discourses of economic protectionism, which, you know, once upon a time might have had some affiliation and some obvious linkage. But even with, say, you know, NAFTA and auto now, I don't know whether you saw that Peterson Institute report, but it predicts job losses in the American auto sector as a result of a 20% tariff in the American auto sector itself. So that because the GM, Ford, Fiat, Chrysler just got too much at stake in these production networks. Maybe 10 years down the line, one could imagine a fully nationalized or renationalized American auto sector. But the short run effect is likely to be, it's more like a sin tax. It's basically just taxing owning new motor cars. It'd be like, and the net effect would be to reduce overall demand and therefore hit the industry and the workers who work in it. And particularly, of course, low income Americans who tend to buy stuff which really does come across the border from Mexico or is imported straight from South Korea, because they're buying the Nissans and the Toyotas and the Kias to get cheap, high-quality mobility.
And this is perhaps a bit too squishy for serious economists, but it does seem to me that the U.S. looks like a very, very tired power. With Trump as president, it looks very inward-looking, backward-looking, snarling, resentful. China is extremely ambitious, skillful, imaginative. The Belt and Road Project, you know, the global ambitions of China are extremely impressive. It just looks like increasingly like the U.S. is not really much of a match for rising China now, and Trump doesn't seem to have what looks like the right approach to deal with that.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure whether to be flattered that you're calling me an economist. But,
no, I wasn't. No, you're an economic historian, right?
Yeah, there you go. But if you look at it, though, from a European point of view, add that third point to your comparison, right, and things get even more complicated, because prior to Trump 2 years ago, you would have said that the U.S. had come out of the 2008-2009 recession far more robustly than and Europe. You know, if you think that America's looking tired, you should see how the world looks from the vantage point of Italy or Germany, even, right? Insofar as Germany has a comparative advantage, it's in genuinely old school technologies, chemicals, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering. Europe is so far off the pace in tech, in 5G, on any of these kind of frontier technologies. This is the real irony, I think, of the Trump presidency, is that, you know, if you choose to view America's situation from the point of view of an aluminium smelter, then it is indeed easy enough to imagine how you end up feeling that America's tired. But of course, that isn't the cutting edge of American capital. No group of capital has benefited more from globalization than the U.S. Of course, you know, they don't earn those profits in the U.S., but they are, you know, it's in sector after sector, the dominant players. If you ask, for instance, who owns BHP, you know, the great Australian quote-unquote miner that has been gorging itself on the Chinese markets, it's majority American-owned. It doesn't look like that because it goes by way of the great asset managers, but the asset managers are all American too. I was just reading this report in the Financial Times this morning. You know, in the trillion-dollar league of asset managers, there's only one European player. The rest are all American. So this idea that American capitalism is tired is in itself a kind of bizarre effect of the hallucinogenic, really anachronistic politics that Trump represents. I'm just putting that out there to somewhat soften. If you take the China-America axis, then I think it's easy enough to agree with what you're saying in many ways. I mean, But it always strikes me with regard to Pakistan, you know, America, Britain, of course, was deeply involved in this as well. So I should say we, like, you know, we dug ourselves in the northwestern frontier and fought this totally unproductive war in Afghanistan. And I don't remember anyone at any point saying, you know what, it would be a good idea would be to spend $70 billion in improving Pakistan's infrastructure, because maybe if we open this up, build some highways, build a global port, you know, we might actually be able to change the parameters of the game in Pakistan. I don't remember that being part of the counterinsurgency discourse at all. In fact, I don't even remember agricultural development being part of the counterinsurgency discourse. And, you know, One Belt, One Road right now is coming in for a huge amount of flack, and you can see the kind of neoliberalism in a double negative. Like, it's not China, you know, One Belt, One Road projects will run into all the same project problems that every other major development program has run into, and everyone will then argue that it's the, you know, blundering Chinese Communist Party that doesn't have enough local knowledge and so on and so forth. You know, there was a big article in the Wall Street Journal that was really quite informative, but totally caught up with that. The Financial Times is kind of running the book on how many of these One Belt, One Road projects run into local difficulties. But in terms of the vision, I find it very difficult to disagree with you that there's a sort of, there's a grandeur of conception and design and a can-do kind of expectation that sure, you know, we can improve Pakistan's infrastructure and it will make a big difference, and they're part of, the integral part of our vision of how China will be connected to the world, that I just don't see the West providing at all, right? And I think there will be a very interesting, Pakistan in the coming weeks will be a very interesting test case as Khan has to move towards talking with the IMF about a bailout, and how China and the IMF relate in relation to Pakistan, I think will be a very interesting test of this. You know, is it a purely negative approach from the West? Do we just go and censor and criticize and audit and undercut what are the work that China has been trying to do there? Or is there a more positive vision that emerges from the Western side?
And finally, what do you think the results of these Trump protectionist moves will be? I doubt it's going to lead to a revival for the American working class. Then there are some, you know, people who always invoke the specter of Smoot-Hawley leading to global depression. Well, what's the outcome going to be in your from your historical perspective?
I know. I don't think we're in that kind of world at all. I mean, Smoot-Hawley, after all, had the effect that it did in conjunction with a very different set of parameters. Really massive currency wars, collapse of the gold standard, and a system in which the entire world owed America dollars and was unable to run a current account surplus with the United States. I mean, that obviously is not our configuration in the present. We're in a kind of inverted reality. So that is liberalism's sort of lowest common denominator when we start bringing Smoot-Hawley out. It's a bit like, you know, claiming that the EU's major function in life is to prevent World War III and Germany, you know, stopping Germany from invading Belgium or something. I mean, these are fantasies of the 1930s that are recycled for specific political purposes and don't really have much bearing on our current situation. Insofar as there is a global recession coming, it's coming through the general mechanisms of big credit build-up, the unwinding of the long American, the long, incredibly slow, painfully slow American recovery. And, of course, there are some serious tail risks, as they say, in potential financial instability in China and some of the other emerging market economies. But after all, I mean, the world has ridden out a gigantic recession in Brazil without anyone even barely noticing in the West, right? And we did get through China's near-miss crisis in 15-16 through a combination of accommodating policy on the part of the Fed and some pretty hands-on management on the part of Beijing. So, I mean, I don't see a 1929-style implosion or 2008-style implosion, certainly not being triggered by these measures. I do think the real issues are atmospheric as much as anything else, and that this is where I worry a little bit about the left as well, and that this, and of course from the point of view of America, there's a degree of credibility around the national economic policy that simply does not apply to much of the rest of the world. This is not a viable strategy for most of the rest of the world. In the US, I think you could see a kind of clustering of political forces around a strategy that was inward turning, and that for me is really the thing that I find those kind of political accompaniment to protectionism is to me more worrying than the actual economic effects of it.
What was your worry about the left that you mentioned?
Well, I'm on record as, you know, being a critic of the nationalist turn on the European left. I think that the idea that, you know, common on the Lexit side of the British debate, that Brexit is an opportunity for the UK to define a kind of progressive politics, I find this deeply unpersuasive, and its tactical implications, the kind of alliances that one finds oneself in, extremely distasteful, not to say dangerous. And there are analogies to that on the left in the United States as well. And I just find this a politics that I'm completely out of sympathy with. The strategy I would have thought would need to lie in you know, really vigorous pursuit of cross-border alliances with progressive forces in Canada and Mexico is the absolute top priority of American progressive politics, because NAFTA is overwhelmingly the largest trading zone for the United States. Canada and Mexico matter, you know, really deeply to the future of America, the American economy, and to the future of American society, given the extraordinary presence of people of Mexican and Central American origin in the United States. And so that seems to me to be the direction in which I would, you know, I would really want to push. I'm preaching to the converted, obviously. The American left has been pursuing strategies like this for ages, but I worry about the door that, you know, might be opened by this idea that a Trumpian politics of national protectionism targeted at blue-collar Americans and the American working class is in some sense capable of being turned in a progressive direction.
That was Adam Tooze, a professor of history at Columbia. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Empire Song by Killing Joke from 1982. Next, Leo Panitch. Leo is a professor emeritus of political science at York University, Toronto. He's co-editor of the annual Socialist Register. I have a piece in the forthcoming issue, which will come out at the end of the year, on Trump, the right, and the ruling class. In the interview, I refer to his contribution, written with his frequent collaborator and Behind the News guest Sam Gindin, called Trumping Empire. Here's Leo to address these issues. Leo Panitch. It looks like Trump is, I wouldn't say systematically, because that's not the right word to use about anything he does, but it does look like Trump is destroying one by one the pillars of the American empire as established at the end of World War II. You know, he's going after NATO. He's going after the whole principle of multilateralism. He seems to be just acting as if the U.S. is the big guy around. He's going to push everybody around, tell him what to do. His trade policy is mystifying. Is this the suicide of the American empire led by Donald Trump?
To some extent, I guess, although, you know, what he thinks he's doing is bargaining. He is trying to get a better deal in this hyper-nationalist conception he has of the American interest. There's always been a element of the American ruling class, and maybe even a stronger element of the Babbitts in the American capitalist class, you know, the Midwest medium-sized businessmen, and even to some extent the Texas oil men, who never quite got the predominant strategy, which was shared by post-war Republicans and New Deal Democrats, on incorporating other states into the American empire. They just never got it. So, you know, the WTO wasn't created until 1996 because Senator Taft and the Republicans made it impossible for Harry Truman to get it through in the late 1940s. There's been a consistent element of the ruling class. You know, even in the 80s with financialization, when it was obvious the extent to which Wall Street's predominance in the world, its inventiveness, the creation of all these new financial products, was pulling so much capital into the United States that was more than compensating for any trade deficit. Well, even then, you already saw the kind of mentality represented by Wilbur Ross or Navarro. In fact, it was the Peterson Institute that was articulating it in the early 80s, that America's getting a raw deal. Now, you know, I think in an objective way, this is ludicrous. In order to draw independent states into the American empire, especially ones that had formerly been foes, like Japan and Germany, the Americans did make it easy for them to adopt the semi-sovereign status in the American Empire. They gave them a very good deal on exchange rates until the 1980s. You could argue the Germans had a good deal even with the euro. And then under Reagan, they changed that with the Japanese. And it's often been the case that they've let other countries have restrictions on the inflow of capital, especially East Asia, which is one of the reasons the NICs, as they're called, did so well, which was that there were limits, strict limits, that the Americans allowed them to have in terms of the penetration by American capital. And that meant they built up an autonomous manufacturing industry. There's a basis on which to say, if you are a Babbitt, well, the Americans have gotten a raw deal. We've offered these guys too much. Now, there's another interpretation, which is that these are such troglodytes that it isn't even a matter of negotiating a better deal for the empire. It's actually a matter of wanting to blow it up and recreate a pre-World War I inter-imperial rivalry world. And some elements of the American state must have an interest in this.
For example, I saw a comments of Yanis Varoufakis recently where he says that Trump is trying to replace the multilateral American system with a hub-and-spoke system in which the U.S. has bilateral relations with every country in the world, with the U.S. as the center. Do you think there's anything to that?
Any realistic view of the world does already involve a hub-and-spokes relationship. The European Union's relationship to the United States partly takes place through Brussels, and the Americans certainly encouraged from the late 40s on the creation of the common market and eventually the European Union. But that didn't mean that they didn't have individual relationships with each of the states, especially insofar as one's talking about their relationship to NATO. The military strategic security relationship goes through each of the European states. So there's always been a hub-and-spoke relationship complemented by the multilateral. And the multilateral one, the American MNCs wanted, because they wanted completely open capital markets and trade relationships inside Europe. When they invested, say, in Spain, Ford wanted to be able to sell right across Europe from the plant in Spain. That didn't replace a hub-and-spokes one. Now, could it be, and I think it could be, that people like Navarro and Ross and even Trump, insofar as he has a clear view on these things, think that this hyper-nationalist American national interest would be better served by doing away with the EU. It's possible. I mean, just like there are many Marxists, Doug, who have never gotten over seeing the world in terms of the old theory of imperialism. So there are many on the right who see the world in a similar way and, you know, therefore don't understand the extent to which the creation of this global capitalist system under the aegis of an informal American empire has actually redounded to the great benefit of the United States. And you can see the reaction, the resistance coming from so much of the establishment and, of course, from the multinational corporations and the Wall Street banks. To this. Now, that's not to say they can stop this. They are sitting there with bated breath, just as Germany and China are, wondering how far these idiots will take this.
Well, now let's talk about a bit about China. China looks like the up-and-comer in a lot of ways, developing its own substantial technological manufacturing capacity, no longer just the workshop of the world working at low wages, with very ambitious imperial schemes like the Belt and Road scheme to building infrastructure around much of the world, while the U.S. is looking inward and is bitter and backward-looking. Is China about to surpass the U.S. in some sense? Not about to, but on the path to surpass the U.S. in some sense?
Well, not in our lifetime, and I don't think even in the case of your son, Ivan, who's much younger than my children. Look, there are elements of the American state which obviously have an interest in fomenting inter-imperial rivalry. To some extent, the Defense Department, ironically, the security establishment that Trump is so at odds with, part of the tension with China and with the Soviet Union, relates to the interest that those elements of the state have in what E.P. Thompson, back in the early 80s, at the time of the Cruise Missile Crisis, called the logic of exterminism, between those elements of the Soviet bureaucracy and those elements of the American bureaucracy. And to some extent, that goes on with China as well. It builds up their bureaucratic apparatuses that have this kind of rivalry going on, even though they can be a lot more cautious about actually wanting to go to war. And I think they are. They do want to keep up the tension. And so do the multinational corporations, of course, who create the toys that they play with, the lethal toys that they play with. But insofar as you're talking about the economic dimension, the fact is that while it was always going to be much more difficult to integrate China, or Russia for that matter, into the informal American empire, not least because they were never occupied by the American army, as Japan was, but also because, of course, the cultural differences are so immense as compared with the empire's relationship with, say, Western Europe. But the fact is, at the moment, that China's development, and it has been absolutely remarkable, and it's become a major capitalist industrial state, as you say, at the moment, it's very much locked into the American consumer empire, the Western consumer empire, but especially the American. It does not have what we on the left used to call a Fordist strategy yet in place, whereby its industrial development, its accumulation, is reinforced by selling to its own middle class and working class. It requires access to foreign markets, and especially the American market. Secondly, the squeeze that the Americans are putting on them in terms of Trump is putting on them, in terms of technology transfer, is a very real thing. And the fact is that this is the late developer in history. China is the late developer in history, you know, which has had the most foreign direct investment as part of its development, far more than Germany did in the late 19th century. Japan had hardly any, although they came and borrowed loads of technology. There's massive foreign direct investment, and a great deal of it is American, although it's not exclusively American. And that's really important in terms of their development, and in fact, the response of Xi and the Chinese state generally to Trump's bluster has been to promise multinational corporations and foreign banks that they will go much further in terms of opening up, not least opening up their financial market. Now, that gets very dangerous for the Chinese communist elite, capitalist communist elite. That's what they are in this strange, dialectical, bizarre world. Yeah, you know, that is very dangerous for them because they don't have control over capital flows and the allocation of capital. Things could get very dicey in terms of reproducing their rule inside China.
Well, how do you see the reaction of the second tier of powers, you know, Japan, Canada, EU, to this, you know, Trump's big swinging dick act?
They hate it. They absolutely hate it. That said, there's only so much they can do about it. You know, and to some extent, the Canadians have stood up more than the Japanese have. Astonishing, given that we in Canada are by far the most integrated into the American empire. And what happened to Europe in the 1960s was called by a certain very astute European commentators Canadianization, precisely because the American capitalist class is implanted inside Canada as a domestic class. You know, when General Motors workers make demands, working in Windsor, make demands on the Canadian state, they make it as the workers of a, you could say, foreign corporation. But, you know, that portion of American capital is implanted as a class force inside Canada, as it is now in Europe as well, less so in Japan, because the Japanese have never been very open, and the Americans have allowed this. What Trump realized in his crude way is that there's a degree of dependence that allows him to be the type of shyster high bargainer that he's trained to be. And then he gets advice from the Navarros and Rosses of this world, which is cast in this hyper-nationalist terms, which one can argue, I think, very rationally, is not in the interest of a stable reproduction of the empire. And heaven knows what the result of this is going to be. I mean, I'm not one of those who thinks that there's a rational capitalist common interest. The capitalist class knows that it then rings up the President of the United States and tells him what to do in their interest. You know, I think that states have a lot of autonomy, as I know you do, Doug. And while they are constrained by the structural relations that capitalism imposes. They aren't entirely controlled in it by any means. And I think, you know, just like China and Russia, these capitalists are holding their breath.
I'm speaking with the political scientist Leo Panitch. There's an interesting split going on now with the Koch brothers and the right, or I guess this was called the Koch network now that David is failing. They're really turning against Trump in a very public way, and Trump was on Twitter making fun of them. This portion, very well-organized, very rich portion of the American capitalist class seems to be at war with Trump, but the rest of the capitalist class, you're not seeing like Tim Cook and Apple and people like that really fighting in any kind of, at least very public way, this nationalist agenda, which would seem to be against their corporate material interests. How do you read the state of the American ruling class at this point?
It does show you how narrow-minded capitalists are. Look how long it took for the auto company to come out publicly against Trump, you know, right in their own backyard in relation to Canada and Mexico. Given their how much their strategy of shifting production costs to cheap labor in Mexico has been the basis for their revival in the last two decades. It's really astonishing, and it shows you how frightened capitalists are of the state. Their recognition, the degree of autonomy that states had, how much it can impinge on them, how much capital is dependent on what states do to protect their property, reproduce the conditions of their accumulation, etc. They have always understood this. And what was very, what's now very interesting, I think they're being quiet because they recognize this and they don't want to antagonize it.
They're afraid of Trump's tweeting against them. It's remarkable that the president's tweets can have such effect on these people who seem to be incredibly powerful.
Yes, and we'll look at the corrupts in Germany and Hitler. I mean, this is why we need to be so frightened, that when it comes to defending their private property, their existence, they will in the end be prepared to support a fascist. That's not to say that they aren't expressing in some fashion, quietly, through their trade associations, etc., their discomforts. They are. On the other hand, I think both Silicon Valley and Wall Street, if Trump gets away with stopping the technology transfers as part of the investment in China by Silicon Valley, and if he gets away with China indeed opening up its financial markets, as Wall Street has always wanted them to do, and this has been a major part of the trade negotiation, a major part of why the TPP didn't include China, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that they were trying to force China to open up. You know, they'll be very happy with this, but meanwhile, they're holding their breath. As for the Koch brothers, you know, I think we see a very politicized fraction of the capitalist class, a highly politicized one, much more than the others, as you have written about so well. And their decision to turn against Trump on this stuff is very significant. Now, that said, the first signal of this was actually the Chambers of Commerce, in which they're very influential. And when you could see the Chamber of Commerce, which has been the most vociferous in terms of being worried about trade deficits, the association of the American capitalist class, which has been least enthusiastically behind the main strategy around trade in the making of global capitalism, when you've seen them articulating their opposition to what Trump is about on trade, you already had the sense at that point that the Koch brothers were very unhappy because they're very influential in the Chambers of Commerce. Now that they're doing it even more publicly is an indication that they themselves feel that is not enough, that, you know, Trump has enough autonomy from the capitalist classes, the major certain elements of them, that he'll bluster on. But on the other hand, there are structural constraints. There are real structural constraints on how far this can go. And those structural constraints have to do with the power of not only the Koch brothers, but of American multinationals everywhere and their interests. And there'll come a point when being compensated for by tax cuts and being compensated for by this vociferously a capitalist in the White House will no longer work for them. And you'll begin to see it in the degree of investments that they're engaging in, and instability in the bond markets, and instability in the stock markets, you know, those will impose real constraints. And the Federal Reserve, Powell at the Federal Reserve has said this. He, at a conference in Spain last month, began to point to those kinds of worrying signs, objective signs. And he's right to be articulating. I think the Fed has most autonomy in relation to this Trump administration.
Yeah, it's very interesting that Trump has made war on so many institutions of American and international society, but he's left the Fed alone and appointed Powell, who is very much an insider and a smooth operator, not some kind of bomb thrower.
Yeah, and the left was so incensed, rightly, about the independent central banks movement that the right, the Friedmanites, the Hayekians, all were calling for. Because that was clearly an attempt to ensure that democratic electoral pressures would not appear on the central bank agenda. Well, the irony now is that independent central banks means that the Fed can be slightly more autonomous than the Treasury from the White House.
Now, speaking of the Treasury, you mentioned in your article for the forthcoming Socialist Register with Sam Gindin that the Treasury may not have the institutional capacity anymore, and actually other agencies of the U.S. government, to manage a serious economic crisis. Let's talk about that some.
This is very significant, and it could apply to some extent to the Fed as well. I think that's what you need to look for. Sam's and my argument in the Making Global Capitalism was that to some extent it's the institutions of the American state, like the Treasury of the Fed, that are more important in the superintending and management of global capitalism than are the military apparatuses or the security apparatuses. And what one needs to look for under this administration is, are they wasting away those institutional capacities? People have most commented on this in relation to the State Department, one-third of personnel not being replaced, the atrophy of so many of its diplomatic capacity. And looking at the Treasury, there are similar signs. In particular, there has been a reduction in staff of the controller of the currency, which is responsible for overseeing the middle-sized banks. Beyond that, there's been a large reduction in the staff in the Treasury, which serves the interagency bodies that attempt to engage in the regulation of finance. Those that were specially set up under Dodd-Frank, and that's not just the Fed and the Treasury, but also the FDIC and a range of other agencies that are involved in financial regulation to the end of preventing shysters, but also to the end of trying to constrain the enormous chaotic volatility of finance. Those are very remarkable and important signs. Should there be another financial crisis, and is by no means impossible, especially with the reduction in some of the regulations that have taken place, written by the Treasury, that legislation looks like it's coming from Congress, and it is officially. That never happens without the Treasury actually writing the amendments in the legislation back. And they've been involved in this, so see volatility, which is the essence of this financial market, having effects in Argentina, in Turkey, in Indonesia, in Italy, it is bound to have some effects internally as well. Not least because, any disturbance in those markets has a disturbing effect on the international banks located on Wall Street. But there's also domestic reason why there's instability in volatility. Should there be a crisis and should the Treasury not have the capacity to contain that crisis, this will be very, very serious. It's less evident that the Fed, although the Fed collaborated in allowing these deregulations from Dodd-Frank to take place, the Treasury took the lead. The Fed was more passive. Powell, before he became chair of the Fed, was complicit in it to some extent. But the lead was taken by the Treasury. So this is very important that the Fed, as you say, is still run by an insider who understands the Fed's role in this respect. The Treasury, not so clear, and one really needs to watch this.
Finally, we've only had about a minute or two left, but this war on these institutions that we've been talking about, or the neglect of them, seems like part of a war from the American right, at which Trump is now the sharp edge of, a war on instrumental rationality itself, of a capitalist rationality. It seems to be out the window. What's going on here?
Well, then we have to wonder whether capitalist rationality exists in the head of capitalists or not, and I've never thought so. I mean, there's a certain logic to capitalism, but too many people on the left, and to some extent even macroeconomic Keynesians, think that that logic is apparent to all of the actors, and that what actors do don't disturb that logic. Heaven knows they do. And under a Trump administration, people who make appeals to the logic of capital, you know, need to be very, very careful. You know, this is an incredibly contradictory and chaotic system. There isn't equilibrium that occurs behind the backs of capital. It very much needs managing. And, you know, because of the conflicts inside society that capitalism produces, we see that those conflicts, especially when there isn't a left that is very powerful in the United States, to put it mildly, then, you know, those conflicts take the form of all kinds of morbid symptoms. And we see, you know, working class people who voted Democrat since the 30s being frustrated to such an extent that they vote for these type of charlatans. And that can have a devastating effect in terms of the logic of capital, in terms of instrumental rationality.
Jose Leo Panish, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at York University, Toronto. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another 1980s oldie, about which its writer said, the lyrics are purposely structured so that it would be devoid of meaning. Each subsequent line would undermine any sort of meaning established by the last line. It was the early 80s and all our peers were writing songs full of meaning. It was our way of rebelling. It's Take the Skinheads Bowling by Kemper Van Beethoven. Till next week, bye.